Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Amanda Foreman. Her book, A World on Fire, Britain's Crucial Role in the American Civil War, just came out in paperback. She joins us by telephone from, I'm guessing, Manhattan.
Yes, that's right.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Amanda, when I see a book this massive, sometimes I worry, but this book, I stayed up to the wee hours of the night reading it, and it's just a real page-turner.
Oh, well, that's incredibly kind of you to say, and that really does thrill me, because this was the great debate between myself and the publishers, was what to do. We all knew that I'd written a very long book. It is 1,000 pages. and as, you know, as we all know, the trend nowadays is for smaller books. We're so busy, the internet, electronic books, our minds are constantly bombarded by, you know, extraneous things. And it's hard to sit down with a really big book. But ultimately, the publishers felt this was something that people, you know, would enjoy, could lose themselves in, and wouldn't be dragged down by the sheer number of pages.
I understand that your previous book, Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire, planted the seed for this one. What was the connection?
Well, that's right. When I was researching at Chatsworth, which is this incredible palace in northern England, in the middle of nowhere, where the Devonshires have lived for the last several hundred years, the then Duke of Devonshire gave me permission to go through all the archives of every single duke who had ever been. And when I got to the 8th Duke of Devonshire, who was Georgiana's great-nephew, it turned out that he had had a very deep connection to the war. And it had begun because he was trying to escape the clutches of his mistress, who was called Skittles.
Uh-huh.
And Skittles was incredibly expensive to maintain. She was a very extravagant woman. And rather than manning up to the situation and just telling her they needed to economize, he fled to America, hoping that she wouldn't follow him. So that was how he got here. But it was 1862, so it was in the midst of the war. And quite by accident, he found himself caught up in great events. And being a very brave and quite an adventurous person, he snuck his way through the picket lines and ended up in the South, and became overwhelmed by Southern charm, by the earnestness of its people, by the bravery and what he considered to be the romance of Robert E. Lee, and not only became an observer, but was General Lee's bag carrier for several months. And then when he went back to England in April 63, he was the unofficial spokesman for the Confederate lobby in Parliament. So that's a very deep connection.
So he led you to this in a way, and then you spent the next 12 years writing it.
Well, that's right, because having seen this particular Duke of Devonshire, who actually, by the way, was liberal. He was a liberal man in his social views, his morals, but also liberal in his politics. He all the things that you associate with liberals today, he was at that time. He believed in toleration, freedom to worship, all these good things, and he was against slavery. So how could such a man end up becoming pro-South as he did, especially after his brother, to whom he was very close and was also a liberal and shared all the same views, remained absolutely and resolutely pro-Northern? And the two of them fell out over the war, over the meaning of the war, whether it was the right of nations to have self-determination or the right of individuals to be free, and of the causes of the war. And this was the kernel of the book, to first of all understand what it meant abroad, and then second of all, to see whether what I was reading about in the micro in England, how that reflected in the macro in America. And then, of course, the book grew and grew and grew, and really it's about the Americans who came to Britain during the war, starting with Charles Francis Adams, but also the many Confederates, the Confederate ambassadors, the Confederate agents, the spies, the recruiters, the secret agents who built the Confederate Navy in England. And then it's about all the British volunteers who came out here, and also the doctors and the nurses and the diplomats and the agents.
When we study the Civil War in this country, we always think of it as our Civil War, that this happened here in our country, and it really didn't have a whole lot of effect on anybody else. And yet England depended so heavily upon the cotton growers in the South that when the war first broke out in the South, they thought that King Cotton was going to control their destiny, and that by cutting off the cotton supply to England, they could bring Britain into the war. It didn't work out that way.
No, it didn't. It's one of the great ironies, of course. Although, historically, if you look at embargoes and blockades of that kind, they never work. So the South reckoned that England, with whom it had had a very bitter and angry relationship for the past 30 years leading up to the war, would be easily browbeaten into supporting Confederate independence simply by having the threat of losing cotton for its cotton mills dangled in its face. Of course, that turned out not to be true. Just as in the 70s, during the oil crisis here, when the OPEC countries tried to direct American foreign policy by turning off the spigot of oil, it did not work. When the South withheld cotton from England, two things got in the way of that. First of all, countries will find another source of the thing they need. And Britain was able to turn to Egypt and India to grow cotton. And the other reason is because leading up to 1861, the previous 2 years had been the greatest, biggest, most expansive cotton crop ever produced in the South. There was so much cotton shipped to England that was, in fact, a cotton glut. And all the merchants and the factory owners and producers were staring ruin in the face because they had so much cotton, they had so much overproduction of cotton-based goods, they all faced bankruptcy. And then when the war came, they realized that with this embargo, they now had a way of getting rid of this excess stuff in their warehouses. And it took over 18 months before there was a crisis in cotton and a cotton famine. And by then, they had already sourced these alternate methods of getting cotton from elsewhere.
Amanda Foreman joins us. Her book is A World on Fire. And another thing that we learned about the Civil War when we studied it in grade school and high school here in the U.S. was the only thing that William Henry Seward was known for, the nuns taught us, was Seward's folly, and that was buying Alaska from the Russians. And in your book, this man is such an expansive character. And starting out, we don't like him very much, but by the time we get to the end, I think it's hard not to admire the man.
Oh, I quite agree. There's a French term which I love, which is monstre sacré, sacred monster. And I would apply that to William Henry Seward, because this is a man whose greatness stems in part from the fact that he is so flawed. Mm. He's huge. He's larger than life. He's chomping on his cigar and he's throwing back his whiskey. But you never, ever question his patriotism. This is a man who genuinely loves his country and is genuinely motivated by a desire to do good for it and by it. And yet his enormous character flaws come into play constantly. His vanity, his ego. He's so quick that he very often doesn't read things through. He's very cynical about human beings. He is a terrible liar. He's constantly weaving stories. He's a trickster. And so it's as if his better nature is constantly at war with his lesser parts. And he once said, jokingly, but I think it was true, he said, "I am an enigma even to myself." Huh. And he is, and that's what makes great characters. And I think he is deserving of his own biography, because he's just one of the most fascinating secretaries of state that we've ever had.
I agree. Here's this guy who seems to have it all figured out. He thought that he would be the Republican nominee for president in 1860. And lo and behold, a guy named Lincoln stole the nomination from him. And the one thing that Seward hadn't really thought about, even though he had everything all figured out, was, gee whiz, the conventions in Illinois, Lincoln's home state. And he didn't like Lincoln very much, but then he becomes Lincoln's greatest ally in a way, doesn't he?
Yes, he does, and that's part of the greatness of the man, that he could overcome his disappointment, which he didn't hide from his closest friends. I mean, it almost destroyed him. But he had this extraordinary bravery. So to give you an example, you know, he started off making a ton of mistakes. One of his biggest mistakes was that he assumed that there was enough Union sentiment still lingering in the South, that he just needed to find some trick, some sleight of hand to reunite the two sides together. And he thought that would be something like the threat of a foreign war with England. He just thought that all Americans, you know, hate England. So if I just stoke the threat of a war with England, that will reunite the two sides. And so he did that. He tried to provoke a war. He tried to provoke England into provoking a war. And all that did was it drove away a natural ally, a willing ally, who wanted to come in on the side of the North, and made England neutral and did absolutely nothing to reuniting North and South. So he made all these mistakes. Then he realized what he had done. And 7 months into the war, at the end of November 1861, there was an incident called the Trent Incident, where a rogue U.S. naval captain intercepted a British mail ship that was carrying on board as passengers the southern envoys to Europe, and stopped the ship, grabbed these envoys, and took them back to Boston. And to give you a modern equivalent of what that meant, it would be the same as if today Iranian fighter pilots intercepted a American Airlines plane flying over Canada, forced it to land, took off to Iranian dissidents, and then allowed the plane to carry on flying. I mean, you just can't do that. You just cannot do that. And America would quite rightly demand justice from Iran if that happened. So this was the case back then in 1861. And 99% of Northerners insisted that America should ignore England's demands for an apology, refuse to give back the envoys, and they wanted to give the U.S. naval captain Wilkes a medal for his so-called bravery. And Seward realized the terrible mistake that had happened and how America could not afford to alienate world opinion, how America was in the wrong, and that they couldn't afford to have England come in on the side of the South. This would be the end of the war if that happened. And he single-handedly turned around the U.S. cabinet and Lincoln and convinced them into returning these envoys with a suitably worded apology. And that really makes him a great American.
He was very good at looking at different sides of an issue, which was an unusual attribute.
Yes, he was. And by the other hand, he could also have that kind of monomania. So the fact that Britain did then come out and declare official neutrality, he took to be some kind of insult, which was just insane. because by declaring neutrality, it actually gave certain legal advantages to the North, which way outweighed any advantages it gave to the South. The South got a few advantages by having neutrality declared, but really it benefited the North more. And Seward could just refuse to see that. And it was something that he couldn't let go of, and it really impeded good relations between the two countries. One of the most moving aspects of the book for me, on a simply human side, is the relationships between William Henry Seward and the British ambassador, Lord Lyons, and the American ambassador, Charles Francis Adams, and the British Foreign Secretary, Lord Russell. Because these four men were absolutely instrumental in keeping the ship of state and the liner of diplomacy afloat at all times. And they, all four of them, were not natural diplomats in many ways. They were all four had character flaws. So with the two ambassadors, they were desperately shy men, which in the field of diplomacy is a disaster. It's one thing you can't be is shy. And they were both extremely reticent. They were afraid of confrontation, but they were very honorable men, and they recognized their own flaws, and they did their best to try and overcome them. And they were dealing with one, in the case of Lyon Stewart and in the case of Russell, men who didn't naturally warm to them. I mean, Seward was just appalled by Lord Lyons. He just thought he was a stuffy Englishman whom he could bully. And it took a long time before Lyons and Seward could find a path towards mutual respect. But when they did finally see the point of one another, they forged this very tender friendship, which took account of each other's flaws, tried to protect the other from their own weaknesses, and bolster and aid their good parts. And it's just a sort of wonderful story of development and support and friendship and wisdom that comes through over the 4 years, which I actually found very moving.
And poor Adams, he was sort of the failure. He was descended from two American presidents, and how could he ever live up to that? And we also get the viewpoints of his son, and these are always very different viewpoints, and it's so wonderful to read through all of these. And we have these journalists, William Howard Russell from the Times of London, and I think my favorite is Frank, is it Vizetelli? Vizetelli?
Yeah.
You've included all these wonderful pictures that he made, and this really fleshes out the book.
Well, thank you. I wanted to write a history in the round. By that I mean an immersive history of that world, the Anglo-American world, so that from the vantage point of the reader, you are literally in a 360-degree circle. And so the way to do that is to present those 4 years through the eyes of somebody who's living it. And so each character, and there are over 200 named and listed characters in the book, is connected to every other character by 1 degree of separation. So they all, in some sense, either know each other or know of each other or connected to somebody who knows that person very well. And it means that you get to have these multiple viewpoints of the same event or of the same person. And it's just sort of that 3D sensation which makes it so alive. And so when you have the journalists and they're reporting on a battle, and we all know these battles, they're not foreign to us, the Battle of Fredericksburg or Appomattox or whatever it is, and then you bring in the accounts of witnesses, British soldiers who fought in it, British journalists who recorded it, Vizetelli's drawings, photographs, accounts by observers. You suddenly get this extraordinary sense of what it was like there from people who they're just outside enough because they're British to have that sense of distance that enables them to notice the remarkable and the unremarkable. But because they are English, they speak the same language, they have the same cultural heritage, and so that they can pick up on the nuances that a genuine foreigner would miss.
The book is A World on Fire. Amanda Foreman wrote it. It just came out in paperback. She joins us on the program today. And you take us to all the major battles. We have maps. We have descriptions of what went on. And it's easy to forget how badly the Union, the North, was doing in so many of these battles and the terrible carnage which was being observed all around the world. In fact, in England, that is one of the things that made them finally think, my, they are a modern nation. Look at how they're killing each other.
Yes, that's right. It's also why in late 1862, the Europeans seriously thought about intervening, because they had these eyewitness accounts of what was going on, and they just couldn't believe the bloodshed and gore, I mean, the Battle of Antietam, shocks them. And these people who had lived through the Crimean Wars, they knew a thing or two about dying. But this was carnage on a scale that they had never witnessed before.
And for the last 150 years, historians in this country have analyzed the Emancipation Proclamation and tried to figure out what exactly it was that made Lincoln do that when he did it, the timing of it, his reasoning, the motivations behind it, etc. And in your book, we get the sense that one of the reasons was possibly to placate England.
Well, that's right, because that was one of the greatest complaints against the North, was that if this was a truly just war, then it would be a war about slavery. And this was said over and over again by anti-slavery supporters, by politicians. They all said in speeches and letters, if we knew that this was a war about slavery, we would support the North. But it is not. One side is fighting for territory, and that's the North, and one side is fighting for freedom, and that's the South, which is, I mean, such a backwards way of looking at things. But it was the reticence about emancipation coming from the North that enabled Southern propagandists to sell the war this way in Europe. And it was a propaganda coup for the South and a public relations disaster for the North. Lincoln had to do this. Unfortunately, though, the Emancipation Proclamation as it stood, because it only freed the slaves in rebel-held states and didn't free the slaves in the border states, was taken as an act of terrible hypocrisy, and it was a long time before that anger subsided in Europe and in England, and people began to accept the proclamation at face value.
Well, I was very impressed by your ability to keep this narrative going and weave in these thousands of different sources. And every time we turn a page, there's another colorful event or another wild character. We have this guy, I think it might have been the guy who was in the Crimean War with the giant mustache.
Oh, yes, Sir Percy Wyndham.
What a character.
I know. Yeah, he really is. And apparently he was so terrifying that whenever he twiddled his mustache, his men knew he was about to blow his top over something. And one time during the battle, I think it was the Battle of Fredericksburg, he got very cross because he thought they were being cowardly, and he started to twiddle his moustache. And immediately everyone fell into line because they thought they'd rather face the bullets of the Confederacy than the wrath of their colonel.
Well, it's so rewarding to read it, to find these nuggets strewn like gleaming nuggets all through the story. And I think it's forgotten. When we get to the end, you don't make a big deal about Lincoln being assassinated. It's only a few pages. But I think that we forget that these assassins also wanted to kill the vice president, and the assassin chickened out at the last minute. And yet they did try to kill Seward, and he was grievously injured.
Yes, he was. He was never the same again. It was a really gruesome murder attempt, too. The guy, his assailant, attacked him with a knife big enough to be a machete, practically. And he did actually kill one person in the house, and also attacked his son, who was in a coma for several weeks. And Seward's wife had a nervous breakdown and never recovered and died several months later. I mean, for the Seward family, it was absolutely catastrophic in every way. And Seward could have been able to have run for president afterwards, but he just wasn't the same man. He just didn't have the strength.
When you write books that are such massive projects, how do you decide this is the next one? Are you at that point right now where you're trying to decide what the next one is, or is it in progress?
I have decided what the next one is. I was very fortunate that A World on Fire, despite its great length of 1,000 pages, did extremely well, and it was nominated for 6 prizes. It won one, and that cheered up my publishers considerably. And so they've accepted my new project, which is also mammoth in its scope, although it's going to be much shorter. It's going to be about 600 pages. And it's a history of women from 55 BC to today, and it's called The World Made by Women.
Oh, my. And you're at what stage chronologically now? Where are you? Have you gotten in past BC yet?
No, I'm about 53 BC.
Okay. So what happened in 55 BC?
Cleopatra died.
That's the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Well, that sounds like a really interesting project and a lot of fun to research.
It is. I thank you. I'm really loving it, actually. And that idea came to me while I was researching A World on Fire, because I was very interested in learning more about the reactions and the experiences of the white female Southerners during Sherman's March to the Sea. And I discovered that there was actually very, very little written about women as they experience war, not just in the South, but around the world. And I thought, this is wrong. This is an essential part of war, is the experience of, you know, civilians, i.e. women and children. And so that's what got me going.
Amanda Foreman has been our guest. Her book is A World on Fire, Britain's Crucial Role in the American Civil War. It just came out in paperback. And I understand it had a different title in the UK.
Yes, it's called A World on Fire, An Epic History of Two Nations Divided. And obviously the two nations here are Britain and America.
And that title probably would have confused us over here. We would have been
thinking
the North and the South, and we it would have thrown us completely. I see in your bio that you're a Londoner, but you grew up in Los Angeles.
That's right. My father was a filmmaker called Carl Foreman, who wrote High Noon and Guns of Navarone and Bridge on the River Kwai, and he was blacklisted during the McCarthy period. So he spent many, many years in England working, and then only later on in his life did he return back to L.A. And so I've always divided my life between London and America. So even when I was living in L.A., I was at boarding school in England, and then I did my undergraduate at college in New York and my postgraduate at Oxford. So anyway, now I live in Manhattan. So, you know, I feel very bi-coastal, as they say.
Wow. Well, that's a whole different book. Well, we really appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to The Book Nook. My guest has been Amanda Foreman, and her book is A World on Fire, Britain's Crucial Role in the American Civil War. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. The Dayton Peace Accords of 1995 have made Dayton, Ohio, somewhat synonymous with peace. Next week in The Book Nook, we'll be giving peace a chance when we talk to J. Frederick Arment. He's just written a new book called The Elements of Peace, How Nonviolence Works. And we'll be talking about peace and how we might achieve it right here on WYSO. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.